Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com. This is anti-war news for Thursday, May 16th, 2024. All right, the first story at the top of antiwar.com today, Biden appointee resigns over Gaza slaughter. So a senior Interior Department official has become the first Jewish political appointee to publicly resign in protest of President Biden's support for the Israeli slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza. And as far as I understand, the three State Department officials who publicly resigned were not political appointees. The one Education Department official who resigned was a political appointee. So Lily Greenberg Call, a special assistant to the Interior Department's chief of staff who had worked for Biden's campaign in 2020, said that she could no longer be a part of the administration. She wrote in a resignation letter, quote, "I joined the Biden administration because I believe in fighting for a better America, for a future where Americans can thrive, one with economic prosperity, a healthy planet, and equal rights for all people. I have dedicated my career to candidates who I believed would further this vision. However, I can no longer in good conscience continue to represent this administration amidst President Biden's disastrous continued support for Israel's genocide in Gaza," end quote. So in an interview with AP, Call said Biden was using Jews to justify support for the slaughter. She pointed to comments Biden made at a White House Hanukkah event where he said, quote, "Were there no Israel, there wouldn't be a Jew in the world who was safe," end quote. And he said that, I've heard him say that quite a bit, not just at this Hanukkah thing. So Call said that Biden was, quote, "making Jews the face of the American war machine, and that is so deeply wrong," end quote. In her resignation letter, Call wrote, quote, "Jewish safety cannot and will not come at the expense of Palestinian freedom. Making Jews the face of the American war machine makes us less safe," end quote. So according to AP, Call was a longtime activist and advocate for Israel before joining the government. In the letter, Call said that she had spent her whole life in Jewish communities in the U.S. and Israel. So I'm not sure if she's Israeli, you know, or what, but it sounds like she at least knows a lot of Israelis and has spent a lot of time there. She said in the letter, quote, "People in my community lost loved ones during Hamas's attack on October 7th. Beloveds killed, displaced, and taken as hostages. I am terrified by rising anti-Semitism around the world, and yet I am certain that the answer to this is not to collectively punish millions of innocent Palestinians through displacement, famine, and ethnic cleansing," end quote. So I mentioned here, so it's been three State Department officials, an Education Department official, now an Interior Ministry official. And remember, earlier this week, a DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency official, an Army officer, an Army major who resigned. And he also pointed to his Jewish heritage as part of the reason for that. So it's interesting to see, because a lot of this, you know, you see Biden always pivot to this, you know, always invoking, you know, anti-Semitism and this idea that Jews wouldn't be safe if not for Israel. I mean, and it's interesting to see this pushback from Jewish people who are within the American government. So I think we're going to see more of this. I mean, it seems like there is a lot of dissent within the administration. I mean, that's very clear now, but this next story actually kind of shows some of the scale of it. So U.S. officials see Biden as complicit in Gaza's devastating famine. So this article is from The Independent, and it's really interesting. Basically, it's a very long investigation that they did. Just really the summary of it is that they speak with current and former officials of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, or USAID, as some people call it. and State Department officials, and also with aid agencies working in Gaza, and they reviewed some internal USAID documents that reveal the administration rejected or ignored pleas to use its leverage to persuade Israel to allow sufficient humanitarian aid into Gaza to stop the famine taking hold. Essentially, what all these officials are saying, both within the government, former officials that resigned, or people that were in previous administrations, and aid officials, are saying what I've been saying for the past 7 months, that it's very clear Biden has not put any pressure on Israel, real pressure on Israel, to let more aid in. And they have a quote here from Josh Paul, who is the State Department official who resigned pretty much right away back in October. He said, quote, "This is not just turning a blind eye to the man-made starvation of an entire population. It is direct complicity," end quote. And so these one thing I thought was really interesting here, the statistic that the number that I thought was pretty significant is that they have these things called dissent memos or dissent cables that the State Department started during the Vietnam War. And I know some have been sent by the State Department. You know, there's been a lot sent within the State Department. But this says that there's been at least 19 internal dissent memos that have been sent within USAID, with, you know, which makes sense. I mean, if you're an official, you know, you're supposed to be helping, you know, your job is supposed to be getting humanitarian aid into places. USAID does some nefarious things as well with their kind of influence campaigns and stuff. But, you know, you see Israel blocking aid and the U.S. claiming that they're pressuring them to let all this aid in when they're not really taking any steps in that direction, and talking to aid officials in Gaza and knowing people are starving. And I mean, it is more than being complicit what Biden's doing. He is actively, you know, helping starve the Palestinians. I mean, just look at what happened recently. The Rafah border crossing has been closed for over a week now, for about a week and a half now. And that was the most vital border crossing of them all. And Biden gave Netanyahu the green light to capture it. And of course, that meant it would be closed. So it just goes to show they're completely full of it when they say that they're really putting pressure on Israel to get aid in. And this mentions how these kind of dramatic steps that the U.S. has taken, the aid drops and now the pier, are just, you know, not cutting it. And that the thing that they have to do is get Israel either, you know, the thing that they say really needs to happen is a ceasefire so there could be a full humanitarian relief effort. But they say in the meantime that the U.S. should be just pressuring Israel to open border crossings, because delivering the trucks, you know, through the land is the most efficient way to do it by far. And the aid drops have killed, I believe 21 Palestinians have been killed during the aid drops. So it's just completely ridiculous. And, you know, I think we're going to see a lot of stuff come out maybe in the near future, leaks about internal communications that just show definitively that Biden and Blinken and all of them knew exactly what was happening, and there's probably going to be some pretty damning stuff, especially when they have that report that the State Department put out that said Israel is likely violating the law with U.S. weapons, but we can't really prove it. I am sure that they can prove it, that they have plenty of evidence to show that. All right, so the next one here, Democrats fracture over GOP bill forcing weapon shipment to Israel. So this article is from Kyle Anzalone at the Libertarian Institute. Democrats in Congress are breaking with President Joe Biden and preparing to support a Republican bill that will force the White House to ship 2,000-pound bombs to Israel. Biden has threatened to veto this legislation, and this is a response to Biden. You know, they put on this hold on this one shipment of 2,000-pound bombs, and of course, even though, as we've been talking about, it's not really significant, Israel has everything that they need to escalate as much as they want in Rafah, and they're still pledging long-term support. Biden just signed off on that $1 billion arms deal. But the Republicans are freaking out, and this is basically what they're going to be campaigning on now. So Republicans have introduced a bill that would force Biden to send the 2,000-pound bombs. Biden says he's going to veto it. I think Chuck Schumer said he's not going to bring it up for a vote in the Senate, but there are some Democrats who are saying that they'll support it. And one of them is Richie Torres. He's a Democrat from New York, very, very pro-Israel. I know he gets a lot of AIPAC money. What he said was, quote, "I have a general rule of supporting pro-Israel legislation unless it includes a poison pill like cuts to domestic policy," end quote. So basically, I'll approve whatever they want me to approve. And a group of 26 House Democrats signed a letter slamming President Biden for blocking the shipment. They said in the letter, quote, "We are deeply concerned about the message the administration is sending to Hamas and other Iranian-backed terrorist proxies by withholding weapon shipments to Israel. With democracy under assault around the world, we cannot undermine our ally Israel, especially in her greatest hour of need. America's commitment must always be ironclad," end quote. All right. So the next story here, Gallant challenges Netanyahu on his Gaza plan. So Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Wednesday that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu must formulate a plan for a post-war Gaza and reject the idea of Israeli military rule. So Gallant said that if a non-Hamas Palestinian, some sort of Palestinian faction, that's not Hamas, if that rule does not get established, that Hamas will be able to reestablish itself in areas where its military has been dismantled, where places where Israel has said that it's dismantled Hamas's military. Gallant said, quote, "As long as Hamas retains control over civilian life in Gaza, it may rebuild and strengthen itself, thus requiring the IDF to return and fight in areas where it has already operated. In the absence of such an alternative, only two negative options remain: Hamas's rule in Gaza or Israeli military rule in Gaza. The meaning of indecision is choosing one of the negative options," end quote. So it's interesting to see him say this, because this is happening as Israel's escalating again in northern Gaza, and apparently there's very intense fighting on the ground between Hamas and other armed Palestinian groups. And this is an area where they said, oh yeah, we completely destroyed Hamas, completely dismantled them. But they're going back. And this has happened in multiple places in northern Gaza. And, you know, this is the assessment from the U.S. intelligence, and we've seen some signs that Israeli intelligence thinks the same thing, is that this goal of Netanyahu has of eradicating Hamas is just not realistic. So the Israeli defense minister said that he has repeatedly brought up the issue with the Israeli security cabinet, but that his concerns have been ignored. Gallant said he would not agree to the establishment of Israeli military rule in Gaza and called on Netanyahu to reject the idea of a military occupation, which is interesting. It's worth noting that Gaza has been under an Israeli military blockade since 2007. Which is technically a military occupation, but he's saying he's opposed to, I guess, Israeli troops staying in Gaza. Netanyahu has said that Israel must maintain security control over Gaza indefinitely. They're creating this buffer zone around the border that's taking a lot of territory on the border area of Gaza. They created this corridor to separate North Gaza, you know, and these are things that they don't want to give up. So Netanyahu is thinking long-term occupation. That's not what he's explicitly saying, but that's definitely what he's thinking. So Netanyahu responded to Gallant saying that he is not willing to replace Hamas Stan with Fatah Stan, referring to Fatah, the political faction that heads the Palestinian Authority. And Netanyahu said that the issue of post-war Gaza should not be discussed until Hamas is defeated, a goal that the U.S. believes is unrealistic. Netanyahu said, quote, "Therefore, the first condition for replacing Hamas with another factor is to destroy Hamas and to do it without excuses," end quote. So again, I think this is interesting because Gallant is not some nice guy who's like, whoa, you know, what are we doing here? We shouldn't, you know, control Gaza forever. He's the defense minister who has been overseeing this brutal slaughter and starvation campaign. He was the one who said that they're fighting human animals when it first started. So to see him, I think this is clearly concern that they can't beat Hamas in the way that Netanyahu wants to. And of course, some Israeli ministers and lawmakers are now calling for Gallant to be fired over these remarks, including Itamar Ben-Gvir, the national security minister and leader of the Jewish Power Party. Ben-Gvir said, quote, "From Gallant's point of view, there is no difference between whether Gaza is controlled by IDF soldiers or whether Hamas murderers control it. This is the essence of the conception of a defense minister who failed on October 7th and continues to fail even now. Such a defense minister must be replaced in order to achieve the goals of the war," end quote. And another thing, back to what Netanyahu said, it's interesting what he said that I kind of skipped over. He said that the first condition for replacing Hamas is to destroy Hamas and to do it without any excuses. So that kind of seems like a shot at Gallant and maybe the Israeli military brass. You know, do that. You know, you got to destroy Hamas, and I don't want to hear any excuses. So interesting to see this infighting happening. And Smotrich also, not a surprise, called for Gallant to be fired. All right, so the next one here, Israel escalates attacks as Gaza on brink of catastrophe. This article is from Al Jazeera, just kind of an update of the situation on the ground. Israel has continued its military push in across Gaza with fierce urban gun battles between Israeli forces and Palestinian armed groups taking place in the Jabalia refugee camp in the north to the southern city of Rafah, which borders Egypt. In the northern Jabalia district, now widely destroyed, residents said Israeli tanks have destroyed clusters of homes, but were facing heavy resistance from fighters with the Palestinian group Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. So apparently they were leveling a lot of buildings in this area of northern Gaza. And about 100,000 people have been forcibly expelled from the north in recent days. And they're in Rafah, that basically the Israeli tanks are continuing to kind of push further into eastern Rafah. And they're also facing some resistance on the ground. So it continues to escalate. All right, the next one here, the $320 million U.S. military pier to open for business, but storms ahead. So this article is from Kelly Vlahos at Responsible Statecraft about the pier. So apparently the pier is done, that this so-called aid pier that the U.S. built that cost them $320 million, that they said would cost $320 million to build and then for the first 3 months of operating it. So that number, that cost could really go up. And basically how this is going to work is that they created this pier the length of 5 football fields that will be anchored off the Gaza coast. Humanitarian aid will be dropped off there via ships from the floating pier, also built by the U.S. military. That'll be 2 miles off the coast. According to the Pentagon, 2 Navy warships will be protecting the floating pier and the seabound transfer of the aid. Some 1,000 service members are engaged in the project, which is costing an estimated $320 million. U.S. personnel are not supposed to be going on the ground in Gaza at any time, but it's the transportation from the pier to the, I forget what exactly they call it, but a causeway or another type of floating dock that's attached to the coast of Gaza. And that's where the real danger is of the U.S. troops getting hit. So it's not clear when this is going to start, but they're saying that it could be operational soon. So this was written on Wednesday, and Kelly says that the Pentagon is saying that it could start delivering aid in 24 hours, within 24 hours. So see how, what happens with that. All right. So the next one here, Hezbollah launches deepest drone strike in Israel. This article is from Jason Ditz. Israel and Hezbollah carried out tit for tat airstrikes again against one throughout Wednesday. Scores of Hezbollah missiles were fired at northern Israel and a drone strike against a military site near Golani Junction hit some 20 miles from the border. The Israeli military reported damage but no injuries from the explosive-laden drone. But more noteworthy is the fact that these are the deepest strikes into Israeli territory since the current war began in October. Most Israeli strikes against Israel have been within 9.3 miles of the border, showing a capacity to strike this much deeper. Means that there's a lot of sites they could hit that Israel probably thought were safe. So this is about, again, 21 miles from the border, so significantly further than they've been hitting. And Israel launched several strikes into northeastern Lebanon, which is 51 miles from the border. So Israel has been striking pretty deep inside Lebanon. Remember, they launched that drone strike in Beirut a few months ago. So the situation continues to, you know, it doesn't seem like there's any end in sight to this. All right, so the next one here, Gallant reportedly orders Al Jazeera closure in the West Bank. This article is from Middle East Eye. So another story about the Israeli defense minister, Gallant. This time, he has reportedly ordered Army Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi to block Al Jazeera from broadcasting in the occupied West Bank. Quoting unnamed sources in the Israeli military, Israel's Army Radio reported that the Army was working to implement Gallant's order against the Qatari broadcaster. Right now, it's not clear whether the order would apply to areas of the West Bank where Israeli settlers live, or if it would extend to Palestinian areas where Al Jazeera is widely watched. If they shut down Al Jazeera in the West Bank for Palestinians, I mean, that would be a pretty huge step to crack down on the media. So going back to that other Gallant story, it's just something with Ben-Gvir saying, you know, blaming Gallant for October 7th, when Ben-Gvir, as the Minister of National Security, he's actually in charge of like the border police and everything and other security things like that. So of course it's a failure on his part too. But anyway, not that I'm defending Gallant here, but so when it comes to the Al Jazeera ban, it's not clear at the moment as well if it would mean the closure of Al Jazeera's offices in Ramallah, as well as a block on the network being watched across the West Bank. So it's not clear exactly what this order means yet, if they're just going to shut it down in the settlements or if they're going to try to shut it down for the Palestinians as well, which would be a much bigger step. All right. So the next one here, Blinken announces $2 billion in military aid for Ukraine. So Blinken's still in Ukraine, and on Wednesday he announced $2 billion in new military aid for Ukraine as Russian forces continue to advance in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv Oblast after launching a new offensive in the region this past Friday. Blinken, who made the announcement in Kiev, said the $2 billion is in the form of foreign military financing, a State Department program that gives foreign governments money to purchase U.S. weapons. The majority of the funds are being pulled from the $61 billion in new Ukraine aid recently authorized by Congress, although $400 million is coming from previously allocated funds. So Blinken would not detail what weapons that will be purchased, but said that it's going to be spent in several different ways. They're saying that they're going to spend it so that they can provide weapons today. Usually foreign military financing takes a while for the weapons to actually be delivered. Maybe he's saying there's some kind of expedited thing that they're going to do. The other thing, he says some of the spending is going to help Ukraine's defense industrial base, or its military industrial complex, as the Ukrainian officials call it. And also a third way that this money will be spent is on military equipment from other countries, not just the U.S. So I have the map in here from South Front of the situation along the front line in Ukraine. And you see in Kharkiv, Russian forces are advancing in Vovshansk, which is kind of the big village in this border area. And they took control of several other smaller villages. And, you know, if you look down at the whole front here, Donetsk, saying that Russian forces are advancing in other areas there, and the fighting looks pretty heavy there. And then even in the south, in Zaporozhye, Russian forces are, apparently advancing. So things are just really, really not looking good for Ukraine on the battlefield. But Blinken says, you know what, we're going to send you some more weapons. I'm sure that'll fix things. So the new weapons package brings the total amount of U.S. military aid announced since the $61 billion was authorized to about $9 billion. So they've used a lot of it already. They announced a $6 billion weapons package and a $1 billion one before this. So standing alongside Blinken was Dmytro Kuleba, the Ukrainian foreign minister, and he complained about delays in Western weapon shipments. He said, quote, "Every delay of supply results in setbacks on the front line. This is the general rule. We appreciate the sincere commitment of the United States to compensate deliveries, delays in deliveries with new announcements and new deliveries," end quote. So one thing that happened on Wednesday as well when it comes to the Kharkiv area is that the Ukrainians did announce that they were pulling back some forces, that they were ceding some territory to Russia. And again, it's just a really... This could be real trouble for Ukraine, I think, if Russia, you know, really makes... I mean, they're already making significant gains, but I mean, if they really start turning this blue area much redder, it's definitely trouble for the Ukrainians. All right, so the next one here, Slovakia's prime minister is expected to live after being shot. So this was big news on Wednesday. Robert Fico... His name is spelled F-I-C-O. I've talked about him before, and I pronounced his name Fico, but I actually had a listener who I think was in the Czech Republic next to Slovakia who said it's actually spelled pronounced Fico, and I double-checked today and I saw it in the news anyway. But anyway, so he was shot multiple times on Wednesday in an assassination attempt after a government meeting. And he is in grave condition, but he's expected to survive, according to the deputy prime minister. Initially, they were saying that he is facing life-threatening injuries, that he was fighting for his life. But the deputy prime minister, Tomas Taraba, said, quote, "I guess in the end he will survive. He's not in a life-threatening situation at this moment." So earlier, Slovakia's defense minister spoke with reporters outside of the hospital where he's being treated and said that he was fighting for his life and underwent 3.5 hours of surgery. So it looks like the surgery did some good and at least maybe he's stable. So Fico, who is 59 years old, he was shot while greeting a crowd. Again, he came out of a government meeting, walked up to a crowd, and someone right there shot, I believe, 4 times. Not sure how many bullets actually hit him, but it says he was shot multiple times. And Slovakia authorities said that they detained a 71-year-old man for the shooting and that the initial investigation found a clear political motivation. Now, I don't know much about internal politics in Slovakia, but I know that Fico and his party, Smer-SD, they won elections last year after campaigning on a platform against military aid to Ukraine and opposition to the NATO proxy war against Russia in general. And he followed through on those pledges that he made on the campaign trail when he came into office. He blocked a military aid package for Ukraine that was approved by the last government. And he's been very critical of the proxy war of other NATO countries who have these big plans for these bilateral security deals with Ukraine. So he's very skeptical of this proxy war, critical of NATO. And because of that, you read the media coverage in the West of him getting shot. I mean, it almost sounds like he had it coming or something. They call him, of course, you know, a Kremlin... I forget the one term that I saw that was crazy. Like, but anyway, you know, pro-Russia, anti, you know, NATO, and like just kind of all these kind of like little pejoratives that they used to describe him. So that's, you know, why I wrote this story up. But hopefully, you know, he pulls through here. We might find out more about the motive of the shooter. All right, so the next one here, Niger's prime minister says that U.S. threats led to the withdrawal order. So the U.S. was asked to withdraw troops from Niger due to threats U.S. officials made to the country over its relationship with Russia and Iran. And this is according to Niger's prime minister, Ali Mohamed Lamine Zine. He spoke with the Washington Post about it. So Niger announced that it ended its military relationship with the U.S. back in March and said the U.S. presence was no longer legally justified. Officials said at the time that Niger took the steps due to the U.S. not respecting the country's sovereignty. So Zine, who was appointed by a military junta after a July 2023 coup, elaborated on the reason for ordering the U.S. withdrawal. He pointed to comments made by Mali Fi, the State Department's top official for African affairs, who warned Niger against strengthening relations with Russia and said it could affect U.S. military support. She also threatened sanctions if Niger went through with a potential uranium deal with Iran. Zine said, quote, when she finished, I said, Madam, I am going to summarize in 2 points what you have said. First, you have come here to threaten us in our country. This is unacceptable. And you have come here to tell us with whom we can have relationships, which is also unacceptable. And you have done it all with a condescending tone and a lack of respect, end quote. He said Niger was also unhappy with the U.S. for freezing military assistance following the coup and not helping with the fight against terrorists while remaining in the country. He said, quote, the Americans stayed on our soil doing nothing while the terrorists killed people and burned towns, end quote. The U.S. has said it will comply with Niger's order to leave, and the Pentagon ordered a withdrawal it says will take place over the next few months. But the U.S. is dragging its feet. They're still saying that they might be able to work out some sort of deal, claiming, you know, negotiations are ongoing, but Niger is showing no interest in that. I mean, they just got to get out of there. And U.S. troops stationed at Air Base 101 in Niamey, the capital, they're now sharing a base with Russian soldiers. And most U.S. personnel in the country are at Air Base 201 in Agadaz, which is the big drone base that they built a few years ago that cost over $100 million, the big hub for U.S. military operations in the region that they don't want to give up. And that's why they're dragging their feet, putting U.S. troops in danger. So it was interesting things he had to say there. So go check out our viewpoints. One from Raiho Takuchi. The U.S. won't defend Japan, but Tokyo doesn't tell the truth to the public. One from Dayud Kutab. The U.S. and Israel are playing a dangerous game. One from Janet Abu Elias, Lillian Malden, and William Hartung. The Pentagon is flirting with the dark side of AI. One from Ted Snyder. The recent risk of escalation in Ukraine. And the spotlight from Aaron Mate on Israel, student courage exposes elite cowardice. So please go check all that out. Go check out our blog, other stories at the lower section of the page. You can always support us. Our fundraiser is still going. Hopefully we can finish this week. But if you haven't already, please help us out. Go to antiwar.com/donate for that. Other ways you can support us is by sharing the show, like, subscribe, tell your friends about antiwar.com. I will be back tomorrow with some more news. Thanks for listening.